Hello, my name is Philip Meerton, and today we are going to have a conversation beyond science and religion. Each week on this show, we will talk about breaking through the common beliefs and perceptions that tell us how to think about the world and ourselves. My website is www.heavenattheendofscience.com, where you can learn more about my own views on the topics expressed in this show. Now, the topic of today's show is going to be, what can our finely tuned universe tell us about God? Now, this is an important topic because it tends to bridge science and religion, these two fields of thought that we often believe are completely separated. We go to a university classroom to learn about science, and we go to a different building across town to learn about religion. But is there a way to break down the walls between these two fields of thought? Well, it seems that there must be, because when we look out at the world, we only see one world. We don't see a science world, and we don't see a religious world. Only one world. So maybe we're not looking at this picture in the right way. I'm very happy to have as our guest today Bernard Haisch, who is an astrophysicist and former editor of the Astrophysical Journal. He is the author of The God Theory and The Purpose-Guided Life, as well as over 130 scientific publications. He earned his PhD from the University of Wisconsin at Madison and did postdoctoral research at the Joint Institute for Laboratory Astrophysics at the University of Colorado and the University of Utrecht, Netherlands. He has also been a staff scientist at Lockheed Martin Solar and Astrophysical Lab, deputy director of the Center for Extreme Ultraviolet Astrophysics at the University of California, Berkeley, and a visiting scientist at the Max Planck Institute in Germany. Last, he is former editor-in-chief of the Journal of Scientific Exploration. Now, prior to his career in astrophysics, he attended a seminary school as a student for the Catholic priesthood, I believe in Indiana. Welcome to the show, Bernard. It's nice having you here.
Well, my pleasure to be here tonight.
Now, the first question before we get into your background is, maybe you could tell us what an astrophysicist is.
Well, an astrophysicist is an astronomer, first and foremost. We study the universe, the composition of the universe. And the difference between astrophysics and astronomy is simply the one of which kind of tools we use. In astrophysics, we apply the tools of physics pretty much to understand such things as black holes and galaxies and formation of planets and so on. So an astrophysicist is someone who applies the laws of physics to the cosmos.
Okay, and so now you have two books out there, and both of them I would highly recommend for breaking new ground, I think, and trying to reconcile science and religion or science and spirituality. But what has been the reaction of your scientific peers to your books?
Well, it's a little hard to say because I try not to bring up the topic very much in professional meetings because we were busy talking about astronomy, of course. But a lot of scientists are opposed to religions, and I don't know who is who really among my colleagues mainly.
Right.
So I try not to talk about that too much. But on the other hand, in the second book, The Purpose-Guided Universe, I feel really fortunate that a number of my astrophysics friends stepped forward and provided some very nice comments on the book, very nice recommendations on the book. It surprised me that they were willing to go forward and lend their names to an endorsement of my book. So that part has been very gratifying. But overall, I just try to keep the two topics distinct, depending on what audience or conference I'm at.
Yeah, first of all, I did notice that you got a lot of nice testimonials from professors, and I'm sure a lot of your peers. And I think one of the underbelly issues out there is to what extent many science professors, science writers, have a spiritual undertone to them, or to what extent, you know, maybe they teach the classes, they read the books, they write the books that promote one kind of worldview, which we'll get into in a couple minutes, but how many of them really have doubts whether the reductionist standpoint tells the whole picture. Have you got a better sense of that since you've written these books?
Well, a little bit. I used to think that scientists were probably a 90% level atheist.
Right.
Well, it turns out it's not quite that bad. About 40% of scientists admit to some kind of belief in a god.
Yes.
Now, it could be a very vague kind of god, just a very fuzzy sort of thing out there, which is sort of what Einstein used to talk about.
Right.
But still, it's surprising. It was surprising to me that 40% of scientists do have some faith in God. So that means that even though that's much less in the population at large, it's not totally missing. But still, it's an uphill battle to try to get any kind of recognition for ideas that smack of what scientists call supernatural, as if that were some horrible word.
Yeah, one of the purposes of this show is to sort of take a different perspective on what we call religion and what we call God. And granted, they're big questions, perhaps deep questions. I happen to think that they're important questions. But if you look at books by, say, Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, and of course, Richard Dawkins wrote the book The God Delusion, and the late Christopher Hitchens wrote that book, I believe it's called God Is Not Great.
Yep.
And you mentioned those books in one of your books as well. They tend to prop up organized religion as the enemy, as the straw man, and then they hit it upside the head.
Mm-hmm.
And show how mythical, how absurd it is to believe in this 2,000-year-old belief system. When really your perception or your conception of spirituality or God is actually different.
And it is. Right. I think it's high time that we have a better definition of God. I think the one we've had for centuries is mainly not working in the world. Now, many of my colleagues are faulting religion. I mean, organized religion.
Right.
Because organized religion, that has objectives that are not necessarily conducive to spirituality. There are issues of money and power and prestige and so on. So I think the notion that religions may not be serving mankind very well, I would agree with that. But that does not mean that we throw out with that the concept of our own spirituality. And I think there we're on different ground. We're talking about our own nature. I think our nature is supernatural. And while we may be able well to do without religion, it would be really very foolish not to try to understand our own nature.
Yeah, and I think that that's one of the criticisms I would have of, say, Western education in here in the U.S., where there is not a lot of comparative religion being taught out there. There's a whole nother area of spirituality or religion. Based upon Indian philosophy, Hinduism, Buddhism, and related religions or belief systems that take a different perspective on God. You also mention the Omega Point. I believe that is in the Phenomenon of Man. I think that's the name of that book by Jardine. And a few other of these spiritualists who have very logical systems and have taken a different perspective on the meaning of God, but we don't seem to give them much attention. We tend to fall back into the kindly bearded Heavenly Father in the sky when we start talking about God. So I think that's something that you did very well in sort of breaking through the organized religion barrier, but saying, hey, the way things are looking here, and one of those examples, which we'll get to, is the finely tuned universe, there's evidence here of something more than just a bunch of particles in motion. Is that a fair statement of how you're looking at things?
Oh, very much so, yes. I think that we very badly need a better definition of God, because the definition of God we have now, in many people's minds, is one of wrath, of violence, someone who's jealous of adoration, someone, in fact, who commands his followers to go out and murder other people,
yeah,
even women and children.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. If that's God, then I'm an atheist. But
yeah.
I don't believe that's God at all. I think we have totally mistaken the nature of God. And given that basically all of our worst human characteristics, embedded those human characteristics into this thing we call God, and that's not who God is, not at all.
Yeah, and I think that just speaking for myself, I could agree a lot with what Richard Dawkins says in The God Delusion and with what Christopher Hitchens says in God is not great. I could agree a lot with their characterizations of organized religion. I grew up in an organized religion, as I assume you did as well. But that's not the end of the story. I mean, you point out Einstein, who I'm not sure what we would call him. I view him as I would call him a pantheist, or a spiritual. I mean, a pantheist to me is somebody who believes nature is God. But you, what has been your perception of what category you would put Einstein in?
Well, it seems to talk about, we call him Der Alte, which in German means the old one, the ancient one.
Yeah.
So what he had in mind beyond that, I don't know. Yeah. I think metaphorically, he must have had a sense that there was a purpose behind it all. But I don't think he had any specific belief in a particular kind of God, which is too bad, because I do think that it's possible to arrive at a view of God that is different from the one we've had in the past.
Yes.
But still by what we know today, and which I assume we'll be talking about during the rest of the program.
Yes. Let's go back for a moment now. You started off studying for the priesthood, is that right? And why? And what led you to study for the priesthood? Was it something in your family, or?
Well, it was probably my mother, but it goes even deeper than that. I had the view when I was a kid, when I was not even in grade school yet, that there were two things I wanted to do in life. I wanted to be a priest and an astronomer. And it's possible to do both those things. There actually are astronomers that do research in modern astrophysics today. In fact, it may surprise you that the Vatican Observatory has a very modern facility atop Mount Graham in Arizona.
Wow.
So they do a very excellent astronomy for Mount Graham. So the Catholic Church has actually had a history in astronomy. In fact, a couple of discoveries in the 19th century were made by astronomers. The first asteroid was discovered by an astronomer who was a priest. So I wanted to do both these things, and I pursued them both through high school and on into college. But then during my first year of college, I decided, well, I really have some issues with the Catholic Church. And besides, I do want to get married. I like the lifestyle of, you know, dating and getting married. It would be a lot more satisfying than being celibate. So that's when I left the priesthood half of my path and went into astronomy full-time and made that my career. But it goes all the way back to my childhood.
Well, so at some point, okay, so you began wanting to have a dual path. You wanted to keep the religious path or the spiritual path, but you wanted to be an astrophysicist. And originally, you tried to do both, and then you left the seminary school and you entered into the world of astrophysics.
Right.
And now, was there an epiphany that you had that caused you to go back to spirituality, or have you always had that as part of your mindset?
Yeah, it's the latter. I really always had this as part of my mindset, as something that I thought would be the most interesting problem in the world to consider. Of course, it has impact for every one of us, because we all die, and then the question is, what happens then?
Right.
Some say nothing, some say something very different. But it's a question that never left me. So there was no revelation. There was no lightning from the sky struck me and said, do this, to learn about me, to please me. It was just something that to me seemed like the most natural kind of serious thing you want to think about in life.
Who, as you were going through your education, did you have a hero or a mentor or some author that you felt like, well, this person thinks like me, or this is how I want to think? Was there one or two folks that you followed?
Well, among my local, in my local neighborhood, there were priests, of course, that I looked up to a lot. But I think one of the people I idolized from history was Nicholas Copernicus.
Okay.
Because I thought that was such a tremendous thing to be able to come to the recognition that it's the Earth that goes around the sun, and to publish a book that says that. By the way, that book was published just in time for him to die.
Yeah,
he actually received his first copy of it, the first copy of the book, the day he died.
Jeez.
He was a very conservative guy. I mean, he did not want to get this out and get anybody. So he bided his time.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about the history of physics is how many of the founders were actually deeply spiritual. Right? I mean, there's all sorts of stories about Newton having an interest in mysticism.
Oh, yeah, very much so. In fact, Newton, as it turns out, he wrote more about alchemy than he did about physics. His alchemical writings were purchased in an auction in the 1930s. I've forgotten by whom.
Yeah,
but he has something like a million words worth of text on alchemy.
Yeah, I've always felt it strange that Newton is considered to be, I guess, the founding father of modern science, but he himself was a mystic.
That's true. He very much was. He was, in fact, an alchemist.
But that
does not discredit his physics. And what he did was really put proper mathematical foundation. In fact, more than that, he invented the mathematical foundation, and then used it to study physics. So he really was a brilliant guy. In fact, one of the modern heroes of astrophysics is a man named Chandrasekhar. He's dead now, but he was a leading figure in astrophysics and himself won a Nobel Prize. Toward the end of his life, he did a study of Newton. He wanted to see how Newton's work stacked up in comparison to our modern perspective. And he found that every time he tried to do the same proof that Newton did for some problem or other, he would find that Newton did a better job than he could do. And that's with 300 years of more experience backing him up. Chandrasekhar could not achieve what Newton did. And he said that, in his opinion, Newton was probably the most brilliant person ever, any field, anywhere, ever. And I think he's probably right.
Yeah, well, it's amazing. I mean, he is the Stephen Hawking has that book on the shoulders of giants. Although I think that actual phrase came from somewhere else, if I remember correctly. But Newton not only described the clockwork universe, but he also really sort of originated or forward the whole concept of scientific theorizing, right? Where he had these hypotheses or these theories, and he went out and they were proved true, and so it really is. It's amazing. It's an amazing story, I think, of physics to see that today we are in a almost 100% materialistic reductionist worldview, where the founding fathers had this spiritual sense to them, and so it's nice to read books like yours and to say, well, things may be coming back to the beginning, because I sort of think that's sort of what's going on now. Let's talk about the God theory for a moment. What led you to write the book?
Well, first of all, I wanted to get my own thoughts together. I've discovered there's nothing like having to write about something to have to make up your mind about how you feel about it.
Yeah.
So you can kind of be wishy-washy in your thinking, but when you write something, it's either, black and white, literally. So I wrote it because I wanted to see what I myself believed. But then the motivation for going public with it was to be a public service. I knew it was not going to help me as an astronomer. I knew it wasn't going to give me any brownie points among my colleagues.
Right.
It would be a strike against me, if anything else. But I wanted to put the ideas forward because I look at the world and I see some really horrible things being done in the name of religion. The worst, of course, are the Islamic fanatics, who think that they will go to heaven and be serviced by virgins for killing people. I mean, it's the most insane belief you can have.
Right.
But even in the U.S., I mean, there are people who think that anyone who doesn't pick their faith is damned to hell, and that God is going to send billions of people to burn for it. And I think that's a crazy belief, too. And so what I wanted to do was to propose both a belief system much more rational than that, and secondly, show how this belief system could be held by someone who is knowledgeable about science and would find no contradiction between anything that you would believe about God and the main science, the Big Bang, for example, Darwinian evolution, ancient Earth, the 4.6 billion-year-old Earth. And these are all things that are essential to believe in because they're part of science. And you can believe in all those things and have a God to boot if you formulate the idea of God properly, which is what I try to do.
Now, if somebody, which I'm sure they have, asked you, well, what is the God theory about? Can you give maybe a summary of what you view the book is about, what the main theme of that book is?
Yeah, the God theory is a concept that there may be an intelligence behind the universe. Because we've discovered over the last 20 years or so that there are lots of laws of nature and constants of nature that, for all we know, could have been very different. But if they were very different, and in some cases very different by only a few percent, we wouldn't be here, because you need the laws of physics to be just right so that stars will form, galaxies will form, planets will form around stars, and that's the place where life can arise. All that takes a lot of special characteristics on the part of the laws of nature. And so the idea that a universe has laws of nature behind it that are just right, that's pretty much an accepted part of astrophysics now. But the question is, why are they just right? And this is where we have two divergent views. The first view, the one in mainstream science, that the universe looks special because, well, there have to be many other universes. And that way, ours is not really special. It's just the one we happen to be living in, because it couldn't exist in any other one. Lots and lots of other universes make that work. Something like 10 to the 500th power universes to make that idea work within the context of what's called M3. In my view, we have these just right laws of nature and constants of nature because they were meant to accomplish something. And that accomplishment is meant to be the conditions being just right on the surfaces of at least some planets for life to evolve and for life to then present a way for consciousness to enter into life forms and experience itself. What we're talking about is a plan for God to experience his or her own nature, his or her own being, through the living things that can exist in a universe like ours. And I think that's why the universe is finely tuned. And that has nothing to do, by the way, with intelligent design. That's totally different.
Yeah, and I think that is the first distinction to make. We're not talking about, and you're not talking about, the classic intelligent design, which really says that the God of the Bible is real, and he or she, I guess it's a he, is directing the course of events from on high.
Yeah.
And there's no logic, there's no methodology to how he is doing this. It's all based upon belief. Now you mentioned something which is the theme of the show, which is the finely tuned universe. And as you know, I think the finely tuned universe issue is coming more to the front burner, primarily because of the multiverse and the book The Grand Design by Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow. Because in that book, I think Stephen Hawking, who writes very clearly, or maybe Leonard wrote the book, says that the way to explain the finely tuned universe is through the multiverse concept. And I will tell you that a lot of people that I've talked to and some of the blogs I've read, if we took a vote right now, what do you think is more likely, that there's 10 to the 500 power more universes, or that there is an intelligence behind the scenes? I think the intelligence would probably win the vote.
I hope so.
And maybe for the listeners, this multiverse is something that maybe it's impossible to get your head around, because the concept of, first of all, the number 10 to the 500 is so enormous that itself is probably not conceptual or intelligible. But the multiverse, perhaps you could try to explain it in your own words and what the multiverse really is.
Well, it's really just hobbled up in order to try to explain away the specialness of our own universe. And there's no evidence whatsoever for a multiverse. But scientists realize that, look, if the universe is going to look special, we don't want it to be special, we've got to come up with some explanation that, you know, is logical and rational, and that does away with the need for any kind of intelligence. And so if you postulate that there are many other universes that have different properties, whose laws of nature are slightly different, you know, for example, instead of E equals MC squared, you have one where E equals MC cubed. I'm
right.
Making that up.
Right.
But if you've got different laws like that, then different conditions will prevail, and you'll have a totally different kind of universe. In fact, we wouldn't even recognize it as a universe, because we wouldn't even be able to see anything in it or understand it in any way, because it would be based on totally different laws of nature and perhaps even different dimensions. So when it was realized that you can invoke such a concept, without any proof, of course, but you can invoke such a concept and maybe even do a bit of mathematics behind it, it got to be popular, because you really have to explain something away. That explaining something away has to be the specialness of our own universe. And you can give that up if you want to, using these multiverse arguments. But basically, I don't find the multiverse than that. It's something cobbled up to try to do away with why our universe might be seen as special.
Yeah, I think in your the book, The Purpose Guided Universe, you come out and you say, well, there's three choices to define or to explain the fine-tuning nature of our own universe. You say there's
right.
chance, which is, if you do the odds, it's completely ridiculous. The multiverse or design, and I think those are the choices. And if for some reason, and maybe you've addressed this, for some reason, a lot of scientists have this gut reaction against anything that has the word design in it, coming from the argument from design, the famous argument for the existence of God. The famous Paley, I think William Paley had that example about if you find a watch on a beach,
right.
You know that there was an intelligence behind the watch. And then we have Richard Dawkins' book, The Blind Watchmaker, which was a play on
right.
that concept. What is your, what, why do you think there is such this visceral reaction against the concept of design in the scientific community?
It goes back, I think, to the enmity between religion and science that it was part of the growing up time of science back in the 16th, 17th centuries. I mean, let's face it, the church was not very kind to heretics. And so people who went into science, what then would be called natural philosophy, I suppose, had to be very careful not to cross the church, because the church is very powerful. They could imprison you, torture you, kill you if they wanted to for believing the wrong thing. Which I guess is one reason why Copernicus didn't get his copy of his book until the day he died. So that certainly caused a lot of hard feelings that have persisted through the centuries. But I just kind of thrown out the baby with the bathwater, and the religions and institutions aspect that caused much trouble. That's not causing that kind of trouble anymore today. You don't need this visceral reaction against the religions. On the other hand, there are religions that, try to put down science, as do the creationists. And that also is something that will turn scientists off very quickly, because clearly it's wrong, and it espouses a view that sees science as kind of an unprovable sort of thing. Scientists say one thing, but yeah, you don't have to believe that. Well, that doesn't make any sense at all in the modern world, because we build our world based upon science and technology, and it seems to work pretty well.
Yeah, there. The other issue. I think that's a very helpful perspective, because it's something that I'm personally interested in, which is trying to find a way to be logical and spiritual at the same time. Because there must be a way to do it. If spirituality is correct, if there's truth to it, then you should be able to be a human being, use your reason, and get there. And I think that what we just talked about, which is we have indisputable proof that we live in a finely tuned universe. And in fact, the more you look at some of these constants, ratios, forces, and the way they all fit together to allow life to exist, the more you sort of get to that conclusion that something is going on. And I think that the multiverse, to me, is really an act of desperation. I mean, to me, I'm saying that in a nice way. I think it's, maybe that's not nice, but I think it's an act of desperation, because to me, it is such a violation of Occam's razor. I actually have read, I forget who it was, trying to rationalize why the multiverse is not a violation of Occam's razor. I think you mentioned it as well, but for those who don't know, I mean, Occam's razor basically says that the less assumptions you make, the better the theory, or a simpler theory is better than a more complicated theory, and there's all sorts of rephrasings of it, right? I mean, but Occam's razor is a fundamental principle of scientific theorizing, isn't it? I mean, it's.
Well, it is. It's not really something that is of universal application. It's sort of a rule of thumb.
Right.
The fewer hypotheses you have to explain something, the more likely it is to be true.
Right.
So you look for simplicity, and simplicity is generally correct, but it's not always correct. There's no guarantee it's correct. but generally it is. So it's a guideline, but to use that guideline as a sledgehammer against the God that doesn't coincide with what science would like to see today, that's a misuse of it.
Yeah, now there's another link that you make to the spiritual nature of reality, and that is the topic of the quantum theory. And I think that, to me, that adds another element of proof or evidence to the God theory or to the belief that there is a intelligent mind, spirit, whatever, behind the scenes. And you are not a quantum theorist, but what is it about quantum theory that you think supports the cause here or supports your argument?
Well, it's the measurement problem. The fact that there are experiments that you can do in the physics lab that haven't been done. It really required consciousness to make the experiment come out. That you could set up situations where things could take on two different properties, A or B. Which way they're going to come out depends upon how you, what your observation of the result is going to force. The thing with quantum physics is that you need to make a measurement finally happen, and the intervention of an observer is where the consciousness comes into the physics and enters into it and suggests that the whole process of physics, since from the bottom up, is being created by quantum phenomena which are subject to observation, to the effects of the observer, to the consciousness of the observer, that applies all the way up. If that applies at the quantum level, then it should apply all the way up to the macro level, because the basis of all physics is quantum physics. And so the dependence of quantum physics on the consciousness to make measurements has enormous implications for the possibility that the whole thing, by the whole thing I mean the whole universe, is a product of an intelligence.
Yeah, we had on the show Bruce Rosenblum a couple weeks ago, who was the co-author of the book The Quantum Enigma, and we talked a lot about quantum mechanics on that show, and it seems as if most writers are, more and more writers, are accepting the proposition that indeed quantum mechanics removes this assumption or this model of an objective world.
But we're still trying to
figure out what that means, it seems to me.
That's right. I mean, at the quantum level, things are not what they seem to be. When you talk about a wave function in quantum mechanics, you might have the idea that this wave function is some kind of strange electromagnetic thing, but it's not. The question is what a particle is before it's measured. The wave function is something that's spread out, like a wave in space. That wave in space is spread out. How does this force an atom to be in one place versus another? Well, the answer is that the atom is a wave function thing. There is no solid atom at the level of pre-measurement. There is no solid substance. There is no solid particle at the level before measurement. It's the measurement that takes the quantum wave function and makes it real. And so what we're saying, which is really radical, but apparently true, that the world does not consist of anything solid. It rather consists of potentials that are actualized by consciousness. And that's really how quantum experiments are coming out.
Yeah, and so you know, the picture to me is starting to get filled in, which is that if when you add the perennial philosophy, which we'll elaborate on this in a second, with the role of consciousness in quantum physics, we mix in the fine-tuning feature, and it looks as if at the base of reality, we have a mind, or one consciousness that is creating the world, as opposed to some mechanical machine that sort of appeared from nothing. And the more I talk to people, the more books I'm reading on this topic, it seems as if things are moving slowly there. There's going to have to be some dramatic event that it's going to occur in the university classrooms for anything real to happen. But it just seems to me that that's where things are moving. Is that your sense, or am I getting ahead of myself?
It's hard to know. I don't really have a bunch of quantum physicists as my friends in different areas. So I can't really calibrate them. I can't really give you a calibration on what they would say about this. I mean, I think, you know, frankly, most quantum physicists probably don't understand the metaphysical implications of quantum theory very well. One of the things that was in that book by Rosenblum and Kuttner, he interviewed Rosenblum. I'm very glad to hear that because I think his book is a terrific book. It was a very great source of inspiration for me to write my second book. But what it's showing is that at its base, there is this substance or this uncertain quantum wave function that becomes real upon observation. And there are people that can do lots and lots of fancy calculations in quantum mechanics. It's a very complicated subject and requires deep mathematical expertise, but don't necessarily understand that, you know, their field really implies that there's nothing real until a measurement is made. That's really what consciousness enters into the picture. So it's not necessarily the case that if you're a whiz at doing quantum calculations, that you're going to understand the basics of quantum mechanics any better than one of the undergraduates that took Rosenblum and out. You can fully present the quantum enigma in a way that can be understood by a college freshman.
Yeah, and he made, you know, they make this point in their book that there's really two aspects to the study of quantum mechanics. There's the science, there's the reading of the results, observations, and then there's the interpretation. And a lot of students focus on the descriptions, the science, the test results, but don't get into the metaphysical part of it. On that score, there's a book called The Quantum Questions. It's edited by Ken Wilber. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but
I have.
I think this book shows again the spiritual side to many of the quantum physicists, the ones that began the quantum revolution. And you know, there's Sir James Jeans and Schrodinger. In their mystical writings, they're saying things that are not a lot different than what you're saying in your book about there being that this is evidence of a spiritual world. It's just strange that even though this is where maybe the evidence is going, we have the leaders in science and physics and cosmology who are really materialist reductionists, and maybe it'll be centuries, generations, or maybe this will all be for naught, but tension seems to be growing from what I can see.
Well, it is now. It is growing because we now know that there are particles that basically influence each other's behavior, even if they're separated by light years. The experiments now show that if you entangle two particles, that one of them has property A, if the other has property B, and vice versa, you're going to make a measurement of one of these. The other one is going to have the opposite characteristics by the virtue of the, you know, A versus B dichotomy. And that object doesn't know which property it's supposed to have until you make a measurement. But that measurement then somehow tells the particle, even if it's a light year away, what it's supposed to be. So particles can be entangled across distances that are vast. In fact, that are astronomical. And there's no way to understand this in a classical sort of worldview, or even a pseudo-classical worldview that I think a lot of quantum physicists still have. They operate with quantum laws, but they still sort of think of things as being real and materialistically independent, and they're not.
Yeah, and that was that action at a distance or Bell's theorem that you just mentioned. That, you know, there's been plenty of books written on that, but and frankly, I don't think anyone's ever figured it out. But it, if nothing else, it seems to me it shows the interconnectedness on some deep level in the cosmos. And again, as we're talking about this, it's another sort of piece of evidence in favor of a unity behind the scenes. On that note, your book mentions the perennial philosophy, and I'm not sure if a lot of people know what that is, but can you try to describe what your understanding of the perennial philosophy is?
Yeah, it's basically the concept goes back to the I don't know, 17th century or something like that. I've forgotten who was the first one to broach the phrase. It means the philosophy through the ages. But the one who made it most popularly available to people was Aldous Huxley, who published a book called The Prince of Philosophy in 1945. And what he did was to take his vast knowledge of world religions and sort of side-by-side compare the different religions with respect to a given topic. And you know, how many books talk about, how many religions talk about God as being a being of love, say. And then giving quotations from the Bible, from the Upanishads, from all, the Quran even, all sorts of places that show that there's sort of a fundamental undercurrent throughout the world's religions. You might not see it on the surface. In fact, they might look blatantly different from each other on the surface, and they do. But at the core, if you look at the mystical core of spiritual knowledge and religious traditions, it's pretty much the same. It's pretty uniform. And that is called the perennial philosophy. And as I said, Aldous Huxley published this in 1945. It's a brilliant book. But modern readers, you know, are not going to take the time to read that. It's unfortunately the case that in the world today, things that are serious and a bit difficult to comprehend or just don't make it to the top of the agenda. So that's one of the reasons, in fact, that I try to incorporate some of the perennial philosophy into my own book. But really, I did that because I think it was important to bring that topic into people's awareness, but also because I think if I'm going to write a book about God, it better be true. So I did want to. There's no point in steering away from perennial philosophy.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's nice to know that your theory is supported by thousands of years of other thought. The perennial philosophy is really an imposing set of principles and of ideas, which all sort of assemble around the same point, which is that there's a unified ground of being, and I completely agree with you that we tend to ignore those kinds of books. But what gives me some encouragement is how many books are being written and sold on string theory, on the multiverse, on the God particle. Those books are not easy to understand either. So maybe it's just a matter of shifting people's attention from the speculations of the quantum physicists and the cosmologists to some of these older, more traditional spiritual texts. On that, with regard to the God particle, do you have any, or I guess the Higgs boson, have you given any thought to that and on how that fits into your thinking, or is that something you've been following?
I have, yeah, because I frankly myself hope they don't detect it. I think it would be much more interesting if they did not detect it.
Yeah, well,
so I've tracked it. You know, I'm following the progress of it, but it's not just awakening. Like, my God, would happen overnight. But I am trying to keep track of it.
Yeah.
But I do hope it doesn't get discovered. I think that we have more issues if it doesn't.
Well, I'm that is always appealed to me, and because I bought the Leon Letterman's book, The God Particle, when it came out. I don't know why I did. I think because I'm the type that actually reads these books. And
yeah.
I thought it was very interesting, and I think they've already admitted it was a marketing ploy to call it the God particle. But the more I look at it, the more it's for that thing to exist, it's got to be finely tuned again. You have to have this special field that's going to give the mass to all the particles in the standard model.
Yeah.
And so I think somebody said, well, you basically trade one mystery for another, you know, the mystery of where masses come from, and then the next mystery would be if there is the Higgs boson, where did the Higgs boson come from?
It's a little bit like the multiverses. Where did the multiverses come from?
yeah, it all
the
sort
same,
of...
The same kind of trying to back up and back up and realizing, well, there's no end to this backup. Unless we accept some uncreated beginning, there's no end to the backup.
Yeah, and I think that's really says it all, because at the end of the day, we're sitting here in a finely tuned universe. We are somehow lucky enough to have everything matched up and combined so that we can experience life and have things to eat and places to go and air to breathe and three dimensions to work in, etc. And most of us just take it for granted. But I think books like yours, when you look closely at these features of our world, do point the arrow to something behind the scenes. Bernard, I'm going to thank you for visiting with us today. It's been very educational, and I hope that the listeners understand that it is possible to be a scientist, to be spiritual, to be thoughtful, and not to compromise your beliefs. My website is heavenattheendofscience.com. Please join us next week when we'll have Dion Collins, the author of Do You Quantum Think? Thank you very much, Bernard. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much.